content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 10th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we see President Donald Trump. He's on the street, and he is plastering wanted posters on the wall of a building. He's working on one for Christopher Wray, pushing the squeegee up to glue it down. He's already put up wanted signs for Adam Schiff, Letitia James with their pictures, and James Comey. And the one for James Comey has a big red X over it. The headline is Enemies List. After the Comey indictment, who will Trump target next? We've picked that up on the Controversy of the Week. Start with the first main story. Government shuts down amid partisan gridlock. What happened? Federal government shut down this week after Democrats and Republicans failed to strike a spending deal, leaving some 750,000 federal workers furloughed and many in fear that their jobs could be terminated by the Trump administration. The shutdown arrived after days of acrimony and little productive negotiation. Senate Republicans, who need at least 7 Democratic votes to overcome a filibuster, insisted Democrats pass a House-approved bill to extend funding through November 21st. Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said any spending bill must extend the Affordable Care Act's enhanced subsidies due to expire in December and roll back $1 trillion in Medicaid cuts enacted in Trump's tax and spending law, proposals Republicans call a non-starter. Trump falsely claimed Democrats want to fund health insurance for undocumented immigrants and posted an AI-generated video mocking Schumer and Jeffries, which superimposed a mustache and sombrero on Jeffries and had Schumer refer to Democrats as a woke piece of something. The White House paused or canceled billions of dollars in funding meant for blue states on the first day of the shutdown, including $18 billion for infrastructure projects in Schumer and Jeffries' home state of New York. Trump warned that his administration might enact mass layoffs of federal workers and cut programs favored by Democrats if the government remained closed. A lot of good can come from shutdown, said Trump. We can get rid of a lot of things we didn't want. Some Democrats dismissed the threat as posturing, but others expressed worry about what might be coming. Asked if he's concerned, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, said, "Who wouldn't be? We have a madman in charge." What the columnist said. The Democrats finally grew a spine, said Alex Shepard in the New Republic. In March, they had the chance to shut down the government and buck an administration lavishing billions on Trump's deportation machine while slashing health care and social spending. Schumer and 9 colleagues caved then, but now they've gone to the mat to call attention to a lawless administration that wants to transfer wealth from the poorest people in the country to the richest. If the Affordable Care Act's tax credits lapse, an estimated 4 million people will lose coverage, and 22 million more will see their annual premiums double to an average of $1,904. Democrats' demands are outrageous, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial, and Republicans are right to stand firm. Undoing Medicaid cuts and extending failed Obamacare subsidies would add $662 billion to the deficit over the next 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. A ransom of that magnitude, just to keep the government running for a few weeks, is a ridiculous demand designed solely to appease rabid progressives. Both parties are betting the other will bear the brunt of public wrath for the shutdown, said Aaron Blake in CNN.com. But guessing who will prevail is harder than it's usually been. The side that forces a shutdown to gain concessions is almost always the one that gets the blame. But the demand to extend Obamacare tax credits is actually quite popular. A June poll showed overwhelming support for the subsidies, with Americans in favor 77% to 22%. And Trump pollster Tony Fabrizio warned in July that Republicans in competitive districts risk losing significant ground if they can be tied to rising premiums and loss of coverage. Democrats are making a high-stakes gamble, said Eric Levitz in Vox. Trump may mean business about using a shutdown as a pretext for disemboweling the regulatory state. It's a longtime goal of his budget director, Russell Vought, who preemptively ordered agency heads to prepare plans for mass firings. That fear kept Schumer in line last March, but there's reason to believe the threat of mass firings is a bluff. For one thing, it'd be no more legal during a shutdown than at any other time. But this administration has made it clear it has little reverence for constitutional constraints and may see the shutdown as an opportunity. Right now, the route back out is hard to see, said Jack Blanchard and Dasha Burns in Politico. Republicans say they're willing to negotiate on health care, but only after Democrats first back a short-term funding extension. Under strong pressure from the base to show some fight, Democrats are unlikely to cave anytime soon. Both sides seem to be digging in for the long haul, and instead of negotiating in earnest or chucking insults and posting memes, don't hold your breath for a speedy outcome. And a second, shorter main story. Trump vows to use military on enemy within. What happened? President Trump told an unprecedented gathering of military top brass this week that America was under invasion from within and that soldiers should use dangerous cities like Chicago and Portland as training grounds. The more than 800 generals, admirals, and other officers were summoned from posts around the globe to assemble at Marine headquarters in Quantico, Virginia, solely to listen to remarks by Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. In his rambling 75-minute speech, Trump aired grievances about his predecessors and the Nobel Prize Committee and said he would straighten out cities that are run by the radical left Democrats with help from the military. That's a war, too, he said. It's the enemy from within. Noting that officers swear an oath to defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and emphasizing domestic, he said earlier presidents had also used the military to keep peace on U.S. territory. Hegseth said he'd purge the Pentagon of woke ideas about diversity, saying, "We're done with that stuff." Women in combat units, he said, would have to meet the highest male standard, and fat or bearded soldiers would not be tolerated. He also said he would lift stupid rules of engagement and review the definitions of so-called toxic leadership, bullying, and hazing. Some veterans approved the comments, but many reacted with dismay. "Today at Quantico was a disgusting scene," said Representative Jason Crow, Democrat from Colorado, a former Army Ranger. "A draft dodger and former Fox News host lecturing military commanders about fitness and facial hair." What the columnist said: Trump's nakedly partisan appeal was a violation of every standard of American civil-military relations, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. He gave his officers the rhetorical junk food buffet of a MAGA rally with rants against George Soros and the fake media, a slurred musing on the concept of battleship, and an aside about the power of nuclear, which he called one of the two N-words that you can't use. Hegseth, at least, presented some common sense ideas, said National Review in an editorial. There's nothing wrong with insisting on a merit-based culture and high standards of physical fitness. Both men converge on one goal, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch: to get honorable officers to overcome the moral squeamishness they have about using the troops as muscle in a persecution campaign. The brass is now expected to treat certain American tribes as enemies starting with the Democratic Party, and to shrug off the constraints of the Geneva Conventions. While Trump came across as buffoonish, the substance of his speech was as serious as a heart attack, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. The U.S. president told his flag officers they should be getting ready to fight Americans instead of foreign foes, and he showed particular glee when urging them to use violence against protesters, saying, "They spit, we hit." The generals must now realize that at some point they are likely to be forced to choose between Trump and their oaths to defend the Constitution. And the controversy of the week, Comey indictment. Is the justice system broken? With the prosecution of James Comey, our country has entered a grave new period of injustice, said the New York Times in an editorial. Lindsey Halligan, a former personal lawyer for President Trump, newly elevated to U.S. attorney in Virginia, obtained a grand jury indictment against the former FBI director last week on highly dubious charges that he made false statements and obstructed Congress during a 2020 Senate hearing. The indictment nearly didn't happen. Scrambling to beat the statute of limitations with no career prosecutors willing to assist, Halligan herself presented the case to the grand jury, which rejected a perjury charge and only narrowly approved the remaining counts. But happen it did, and Trump's years of threats to prosecute his political enemies, Comey in particular, whom Trump blames for what he calls the Russiagate hoax, became America's new reality. Comey is defiant, said Garrett M. Graff, also in the New York Times. He urged Americans to keep the faith and said that while his heart is broken for the Department of Justice, he's confident of acquittal. But the fact of his indictment, at Trump's explicit direction, is already the most corrupt attack on the rule of law in U.S. history. Halligan has no case, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review. The central claim in her ill-conceived indictment is that Comey lied in 2020 when he stated to Senator Ted Cruz that he never authorized someone else at the FBI to be an anonymous source in news reports about a 2016 investigation into then-Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Comey did not make that statement. It was part of a question from Cruz, though he did deny authorizing any leak. New reporting suggests prosecutors believe the anonymous source is Professor Daniel Richmond, a Comey friend who did leak details of a 2017 meeting between Comey and Trump. But that leak had nothing to do with the Clinton probe, and Richmond at the time didn't work at the FBI. Confused? A jury certainly will be. Trump doesn't care if this case flops, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. As much as he'd like to send Comey to the big house, his primary goal is to put his perceived tormentors through the same ringer of legal process they put him through after 2017. And Comey is just the appetizer, said Tal Axelrod and Zachary Basu in Axios. Trump has ordered Attorney General Pam Bondi to prosecute New York Attorney General Letitia James and Democratic Senator Adam Schiff. Former Trump National Security Advisor turned critic John Bolton is being investigated over his handling of classified documents. And Trump said last week that he would think the DOJ is investigating former FBI Director Christopher Wray, who replaced Comey in 2017. But Trump won't rest until Bondi indicts George Soros, former President Barack Obama, and the other crown jewels of the MAGA retribution agenda. This is not just payback, said David Frum in The Atlantic. Terrified of Democrats reclaiming the House in next year's midterms, Trump wants to frighten opponents away from the political process. He's using troops to intimidate voters in blue cities and ginned up indictments to threaten Democratic MAGA donors like Soros and Reid Hoffman. Then there's the Supreme Court, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. By indicting James Comey, once a top Republican lawyer in Washington, he's sending a message that neither party affiliation nor prior service offers any protection. He wants the court's conservative majority to understand that if they try to restrain his authoritarian impulses, the justices themselves could be next. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for universal health care after President Trump posted and then deleted an AI-generated news report detailing his own apparent plans to issue every American a MedBed card, granting access to hospitals equipped with so-called MedBeds, non-existent devices that in QAnon lore can cure every known disease and reverse the aging process. It was a good week for Claude Crusaders after New York City mayoral candidate Curtis Silva proposed releasing feral cats as a solution to the city's rat problem. This is Mother Nature's way of preventing rats, said the Republican, who added that New Yorkers should view the cats like Batman and Robin. And it was a good week for Prestige Poultry after a Royal Parks spokesperson disputed claims by Nigel Farage, the Trump-endorsed leader of Britain's Reform Party, that immigrants from different cultures were stealing and eating swans. We've not had any incidents reported to us, said the spokesperson. But it was also a bad week for Prestige Poultry after a Florida man put a note in his neighbor's mailbox informing her that he had killed and eaten two of his own pet peacocks to punish her for having fed them without his permission. Craig Volk, 61, has been charged with aggravated animal cruelty. It was a bad week for getting the joke after a Texas officer on horseback quipped that his steed was a narcotic-smelling horse to lighten the mood while questioning two suspects, leading one of the men to sprint away in a panic. The poorly informed fugitive was quickly apprehended. Finally, it was a bad week for sportsmanship after American fans hurled abuse and cups of beer at visiting European players and their family members during the Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black Golf Course on Long Island, New York. As a former player, captain, and as an American, I am ashamed of what happened, said retired golf legend Tom Watson. Europe won the trophy 15-13. Briefing, taking aim at Venezuela's autocrat. The Trump administration is ramping up military pressure on Nicolas Maduro. Is he a threat to the U.S.? Why is the U.S. targeting Maduro? The Trump administration has accused the Venezuelan president of waging war on the U.S. through narco-terrorism. Many experts dispute whether that label is appropriate. But what is clear is that Maduro, 62, is a foe of U.S. influence in Latin America and a strongman who has pushed Venezuela deeper into dictatorship and economic decline. A stolid former Caracas bus driver, Maduro claims to be continuing the socialist mission of his predecessor Hugo Chavez. But lacking Chavez's charisma, he has resorted to rigging the last two presidential elections and using security forces to persecute, torture, and in some cases, kill opponents. The U.S. is offering $50 million for information that will lead to Maduro's arrest, the biggest reward of its kind, and has labeled him one of the world's largest drug traffickers. In recent weeks, the U.S. has deployed a naval task force to the Caribbean that includes some 4,500 Marines and sailors destroyers, an attack submarine, and 10 F-35 stealth fighters. And it has used airstrikes to destroy at least 4 alleged drug-smuggling boats off Venezuela, killing 17 people without a legal process. Maduro calls President Trump's claims of drug trafficking a lie, saying the U.S.'s real goal is regime change and the installation of a puppet government so it can take control of Venezuela's oil. How did he gain power? While working as a bus driver, Maduro rose through the ranks of the trade union movement. He entered Chavez's inner circle in the early 1990s when he began dating his now wife, Celia Flores, a lawyer who helped secure Chavez's release from prison following the former tank commander's failed 1992 coup attempt. After Chavez won the 1998 presidential election, both Maduro and Flores took top posts in government. In December 2012, a cancer-stricken Chavez used his final speech to urge Venezuelans to vote for then-Vice President Maduro in the upcoming election. Chavez died 3 months later, and Maduro, who claimed his mentor's spirit visited him in the form of a songbird, won the presidency that April by a slim 1.5-point margin. Many supporters of Chavez boycotted the vote to protest worsening economic conditions. What policies did Maduro pursue? He continued Chavez's campaign of nationalizing industries, expanding expanding social programs, and cracking down on fast-growing opposition. Maduro used El Helicoide, a futuristic, uncompleted 1961 mega shopping mall in Caracas, as a prison and torture center for hundreds of political detainees. "We would hear the screams all night," said former Venezuelan lawmaker Rosmit Mantilla, who was detained there from 2014 to 2016. "I heard about people raped with blunt objects, others given electric shocks." Like Chavez, Maduro raided the coffers of the state-owned oil company. Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves to pay for the social programs that kept the working class loyal. Then, in 2014, global oil prices crashed, a catastrophe for a petrostate that relied on oil for 95% of export earnings. What happened to the economy? It cratered, shrinking 80% from 2014 to 2020. Three-quarters of Venezuela's roughly 30 million people fell into extreme poverty, and 8 million fled abroad, including 800,000 who headed to the U.S. Inflation hit 800% in 2016 and zoomed past 1,000,000% 2 years later. Maduro responded with price controls, but that only worsened food shortages. In 2017, Maduro nullified the opposition-controlled National Assembly by creating a new regime-controlled Constituent Assembly, which granted itself wide powers to write and pass legislation. Dozens of opposition supporters were killed in protest, and hundreds more were arrested. Maduro was re-elected president in a rigged 2018 vote that triggered economic sanctions from the U.S. Today, a new Maduro-allied elite splashes money around Caracas gained through regime connections, as well as through criminal activity such as smuggling gasoline and minerals, and drug and human trafficking. Does that make Maduro a narco-terrorist? Regime insiders are involved in the drug trade. About a quarter of the world's cocaine passes through Venezuela, and narco-trafficking generated $8.2 billion in profits for Venezuela last year. Two of Maduro's nephews were arrested in a 2015 DEA sting in Haiti after attempting to transport 800 kilos of cocaine to the U.S. They were later released in a prisoner swap. In 2020, at the end of Trump's first term, the Justice Department indicted Maduro and high-ranking Venezuelan officials and military officers, accusing them of leading Cartel de los Soles, Cartel of the Suns, a narco-terrorism network that works with Colombian guerrilla groups and Mexican cartels to ship cocaine to the U.S. Some regional experts doubt there really is such a cartel. There has never been clear evidence that such an organization exists, said Phil Gunson of the nonprofit International Crisis Group. And despite the Trump administration's claims, there is no evidence that Venezuela is smuggling the deadly opioid fentanyl to the U.S. Is the U.S. trying to topple Maduro? Secretary of State Marco Rubio has hinted as much, saying last month that Maduro is not a government or political regime, but a member of a terrorist organization, an organized crime organization. A source close to the administration told NBC News that officials hope the boat strikes will lead cartel bosses inside and outside Venezuela to turn on Maduro so they can return to business as normal. One administration official told Axios that wasn't the goal, saying, "This is 105% about narco-terrorism. But if Maduro winds up no longer in power, no one will be crying." But experts warn that this campaign could end up aiding Maduro, who now portrays himself as a defender of Venezuelan national sovereignty. "If their intention is to topple Maduro, it's not working," said former U.S. diplomat Brian Naranjo, who serves in Caracas. "It's bolstering him." And we'll read a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Why Trump is bailing out Argentina. Donald Trump's decision to hand Argentina a $20 billion financial lifeline may seem out of character for our supposedly America First president, said Paul Krugman. But the plan fits perfectly with his petty worldview. Argentine President Javier Milei has defended Trump's tariffs and deportations at the United Nations, and the doge-like cut he's made to Argentina's government have made him a poster child for right-wing economics. But Milei's regime of economic shock therapy is faltering. Argentina's unemployment rate is at a four-year high. International investors are fleeing, and Milei's party could lose next month's midterm elections. So here comes Trump to the rescue. Even though Argentina is a minuscule player in terms of U.S. interest, buying only 12% of its imports from us. And never mind that Argentina just dropped export taxes on soybeans and struck a major deal with China, displacing American soybean farmers in their biggest export market, or that Argentina has for decades been an economic basket case, making it unlikely U.S. taxpayers will ever get this bailout money back. What matters is that Trump sees himself in Milei, and so a bailout is needed to save his own ego. Biden's worst legacy for Democrats. "Democrats blew it on immigration," said Josh Barrow, "and they have a long way to go to win back voters' trust. President Biden presided over an enormous surge in migration, with at least 4 million undocumented migrants entering in his first 2 years, and likely millions more in his last two. Biden's claim that he couldn't stop the surge without legislation was exposed as false in 2024, when he finally took executive action and slowed the flow. But by then, it was too late. The result of his single term was a wholesale shift in the undocumented population, from mostly well-established immigrants who'd been here for years to a mass of people with no ties to American communities and with claims to asylum that are too often bogus. That, in turn, undermined Democrats' key argument for opposing mass deportations, that communities are ripped apart when long-settled immigrants are removed. And while there's a growing backlash to the Trump administration's cruel and indiscriminate immigration crackdown, that won't necessarily translate into votes for the opposition. A recent poll found that Americans still trust Republicans more than Democrats, 45% to 28%, on immigration policy. If Democrats force voters to choose between Trump's overly harsh policy and an overly permissive one, Democrats will keep losing. This column comes from Russia. All Russians have to pay for the war. Just months ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin assured Russians he wouldn't raise taxes to pay for the Ukraine war, said Medusa. But Russians know better than to take a leader at his word. The value-added tax on most goods and services is now jumping from 20% to 22%, and who knows which tax will be the next to rise. This reversal was entirely foreseeable. In the first half of this year alone, the war in Ukraine gobbled up a third of the national budget, swelling the deficit to 4.2 trillion rubles, or $50 billion, while the global price of oil, the country's most critical source of revenue, was in the dumps. The finance ministry isn't even trying to hide that the reason it's raising consumers' wallets is to fund the continuation of the war against Ukraine. It's a lot to ask of Russians, especially considering that since the war began, via the unprovoked Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, some 250,000 Russian conscripts have been killed and three times as many wounded. While this isn't the first time that the Kremlin has shifted the burden of financing the war onto the population, it's noteworthy that Putin broke his promise so quickly and shamelessly. It's a chilling sign that Moscow has no plans to curtail its military aggression anytime soon. Last word, our in-depth article, a test of faith. As his wife fought cancer, Brandon Beckham fought the federal bureaucracy, said Hannah Nathanson in the Washington Post. Was this what he signed on for when he voted for Trump? Pahrump, Nevada. When the government's resignation offer arrived, Edward Brandon Beckham had no way of knowing. He was on leave caring for Mikkel, his wife of 21 years who was dying of colon cancer. Under the terms of Brandon's absence from the Federal Bureau of Land Management, he wasn't expected to check his work email. So Brandon, who goes by his middle name, had to learn from the news that the Trump administration was offering to let federal workers like him resign and get paid through September. In mid-April, he decided to accept. Now, staring at his computer, Brandon, 45, read that he was too late. The offer had closed 3 days before. Brandon looked at Mikkel across the living room in her hospital bed. She was asleep. Surely, he told himself, the new government run by President Donald Trump, the man Brandon voted for, wouldn't penalize him for missing a message. He composed an email to his bosses just after 5 p.m. As my wife is continuing in hospice and I am her continuing caretaker, at this time I am formally requesting that I be placed on administrative leave until a deferred resignation date of September 30th, 2025, Brandon wrote. Considering my circumstances, I respectfully request that I be allowed to participate. That spring, Brandon was among hundreds of thousands of federal workers weighing whether to abandon public service. Trump had taken office vowing to slash the federal bureaucracy, then entrusted a task to billionaire Elon Musk and a newly created cost-cutting team called the Department of Government Efficiency. In a matter of months, Musk and his U.S. DOGE service wiped out hundreds of thousands of jobs, billions of dollars in spending, and the job security that once distinguished government work. Of America's 2.4 million federal workers, nearly 4 in 10 registered to vote had, like Brandon, cast ballots for Trump, according to a Washington Post Ipsos poll. Brandon liked Trump's vision for the country, which he thought reflected his own conservative values, and believed the president had a good shot at ending the Russia-Ukraine conflict. But as the days passed, Brandon was becoming convinced that the Trump administration's treatment of government employees, large-scale firings, emails he saw as harassing, and strict return-to-office mandates were wrong-headed and cruel. If he were unable to resign, Brandon would be required to report to a federal building in Las Vegas, more than 70 miles away. Round trip, it would cost him 3 hours a day with his children, for whom he would soon be the only parent and sole provider. Brandon felt like he was witnessing two painful deaths, his wife's, of course, but also that of his career. In his darkest moments, Brandon turned to his Bible, and next to it, his leather-bound diary. "God is in control. Nothing we experience escapes his attention," Brandon wrote in early March, citing the writings of Christian missionary Elizabeth Elliot. "I believe this," he added, underlining "believe" twice, "which scares me all the more. Why was God doing this to him? Why was Trump doing this to him? I think he is going to let me fall and break," Brandon wrote. 4 days after Brandon submitted his request to resign, a human resources officer responded. "Per the department, you cannot be considered for this," the email read, "since you missed the application window." Until January, Brandon had felt hopeful about his professional future. After a decade bouncing between agencies, from lawyering at the Small Business Administration to handling contracts for the Defense Department, he'd found stability at the Bureau of Land Management. He loved his remote job, distributing funds to fix farm fences, clear hiking trails, and remove rural brush. He saw chances to rise. In December, he'd been accepted into a graduate program in resource management at the University of Idaho. His supervisor had suggested he apply for a congressional leadership course. Pahrump, where the family moved in 2021 after stints in Idaho and Maryland, was working out well. The children, Elias, 21, Hannah, 18, and Gabriel, 14, liked schools and their new friends. Brandon and Mikkel owned a home mortgage-free. They joined a local church whose pastor and congregants they adored. Mikkel's cancer meant it couldn't last. Still, the doctors were astonished by her resilience. Mikkel was feeling good, she told Brandon. Her appetite was strong. At times she felt so healthy she turned to him and asked, "Are you sure God hasn't cured me?" For a while, Trump's victory in November seemed another blessing. Brandon, a lifelong Republican who had voted twice for Trump, after writing in Rick Santorum in 2016, didn't always like how the president spoke, but he believed what he said. In February, Brandon applied for a clerkship at a local courthouse. He was rejected without an interview, which stung. His pastor told him to pray about joining the staff of Calvary Chapel, Pahrump Valley. So he did. The ministry had always been his ultimate goal, but now it didn't feel right. Brandon couldn't save other people's souls, he told himself. He couldn't even save his career, and he couldn't save Mikkel. One night in early April, he guided Mikkel to the bathroom to empty her colostomy bag. She watched, shivering. Her face looked gray. Brandon took off his denim jacket and wrapped it around her shoulders. Mikkel caught his hand, brought it to her lips, and kissed it. "Today I was thinking, and I remember going on walks with you," she said, referring to strolls the couple took at Boise State University, where they met. "I realized we're not going to have those walks anymore." He hated watching Mikkel slip toward death, but it would be worse, he knew, to miss it because he was driving to and from an office in Las Vegas. So when the government rejected his first resignation attempt, he took less than 2 hours to try again. Brandon tapped out the email on his phone, sitting on the couch next to Mikkel. This time he applied both for the April resignation program and an earlier one offered in January. He attached a screenshot of Trump administration guidance saying agencies could offer reasonable extensions to workers who missed the deadline due to approved absence. Please note, I am not seeking to be adversarial, Brandon wrote in one message. That night, he sent another. My request for extension is based on my being on approved leave because my wife of 21 years is dying. This is exactly the type of request, he added, that objectively would fall within the characterization of reasonable. One morning in late April, Brandon's daughter Hannah walked over to Mikkel's hospital bed to help feed her the first of 32 daily pills, cut in half for easy swallowing. But Mikkel wouldn't wake. Still warm, she was gone. Brandon tried to apply for a deferred resignation for a third time. He emailed a handful of the most senior people he could think of, including the BLM chief of staff and a top human capital officer. Brandon asked to be let into the first offer or the second. He didn't mind which. Over the next several days, Brandon's request was forwarded through layers of management. Reading the chain letter, Brandon noticed one administrator's signature. Its words colored neon red and blue. Do all the good you can, in all the ways you can, for all the people you can, while you can. A few days later, Brandon got ready to drive himself through the desert at sunset. On Spotify, he clicked to a list of speeches from President John F. Kennedy, whose eloquence he found soothing. Scrolling, Brandon pressed play on The President and the Press, an address Kennedy gave to newspaper publishers 64 years ago. Brandon backed the car out of his gravel driveway and started driving, the mountains looming purple over his shoulder. As he passed a gas station, then a casino, Kennedy declared no president should fear scrutiny from the press. Brandon recalled a clip he'd seen recently, in which Trump called an NBC News journalist a jerk. This administration intends to be candid about its errors, Kennedy said. For a wise man once said, an error does not become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. Brandon hit pause. Trump's treatment of the federal workforce was clearly an error, he thought. The president had delegated authority to bad people, especially Musk and the young engineers running Doge, who didn't understand or care about the government and the people who made it function. Suddenly, Brandon thought he knew why God was testing him. It was his job to help Trump correct the error before it became a mistake. As soon as he got home, he sat down to resign a fourth time. He addressed this email to the Secretary of the Interior and to Stephanie Holmes, the department's acting chief human capital officer, who he'd read had run human resources for Doge itself. These people had power, Brandon believed, so he asked them to use it. Please have some compassion on my situation, he wrote, attaching a copy of his wife's statement of death. Almost 2 weeks later, the day before Gabriel's graduation from eighth grade, Holmes replied to say he could resign. Please find attached an agreement for your review and signature, she wrote, signing off with kind regards. Brandon's prayers were answered, he thought. He opened the PDF. He had been accepted into the second resignation offer, which placed most employees on paid leave starting in late April, as Brandon understood it. He sat back relieved. Under that schedule, he would receive what amounted to 4 weeks of badly needed back pay. Brandon had run out of paid leave a few weeks earlier, so he was barely due to make any money in May. It was a blow, given his family was almost wholly reliant on his roughly $80,000 a year income, but the pay provided under the resignation program would cover the missing month, signaling financial salvation. As he kept reading the document, though, he felt his chest tighten. Even though Brandon had been asking to resign since April 12th, the department would count his resignation as taking effect more than 4 weeks later. He was out a full month's pay after all. The day of Mikkel's memorial service dawned hot and dry. Inside the chapel, decorated with flowers from Home Depot and a handmade quilt, her three children made it through their speeches without tears. But Brandon, reading from a piece of paper, couldn't get past the sentence that started, "Love never fails." When his father broke down for a third time, Elias rose and walked onto the stage. He held Brandon in an embrace that lasted almost a minute. He stayed there, one hand on his father's shoulder, until he finished. After both men sat down, Calvary Chapel's lead pastor, John Gundacker, took the lectern. Mikkel was a fighter, he said, who had finished her race. He'd been thinking about what she would have said today if she could have spoken. Then he addressed Mikkel's husband and children one by one. "We haven't finished our race. Our course isn't complete," the pastor told Brandon. "So we continue to fight the good fight, because that's the exhortation that I believe Mikkel would give us." A few hours after the service, Brandon got in the car, asking Elias to ride with him. As they drove past fast food chains and mobile homes, interspersed with stretches of desert, Brandon started talking about Trump. On the campaign trail, he said the president seemed controlled and statesmanlike. But now, back in office, he was attacking people. "He needs to adjust in some significant ways," Brandon said, "like how he leads." Then Elias said something he hoped would make his mother proud. "Donald Trump is really good at finding what people want and, like, sticking to that, which is obviously why he won," he told his father. "But I almost feel like that's a little bit dangerous, don't you think? Somebody who's willing to just say what's popular." Brandon paused. He said again that Trump needed to make changes to temper himself, which would help not only his reputation but the country. Still, Brandon said the president's fundamental approach to everything wasn't wrong. It was too soon, Brandon felt, to give up on Trump's vision for America. Trump, he told Elias, still had his support. The next morning brought a final email from Holmes. The government would not grant Brandon's plea for back pay. A version of this story first appeared in the Washington Post. Here's one of the technology articles. Supersized, the no-limit AI data center build-out. The great AI spending spree has reached an epic level, said Elliot Brown and Robbie Whelan in the Wall Street Journal. Just in the past 3 years, tech firms have committed more toward AI data centers than it cost to build the entire interstate highway system over four decades. The splurge is most evident in remote places like Ellendale, North Dakota, where a $15 billion data center, bigger than 10 Home Depots, is under construction thanks to a little-known cloud computing firm called CoreWeave that has seen its fortune skyrocket in recent months. Last week, OpenAI unveiled Central Park-sized complex in the Texas scrublands and disclosed plans to construct roughly a dozen more of them, a build-out that will cost $1 trillion. Some Silicon Valley watchers have begun to worry about parallels to the overzealous telecom companies that spent over $100 billion blanketing the country with fiber optic cables in the early 2000s. Like the early internet, AI hasn't yet proved it can deliver returns on a 12-figure investment. Morgan Stanley said only $45 billion in total was spent on AI products last year. What might be most worrisome here is that many of the deals involving NVIDIA's prized chips are circular, said Jeremy Kahn in Fortune. In one case, NVIDIA agreed to spend $1.3 billion over 4 years to rent its own AI chips from Lambda, another cloud computing firm, which bought those chips with borrowed money collateralized by the value of GPUs themselves. Such dizzying arrangements in which NVIDIA typically invests or lends money to its own customers could give investors an inflated perception of the true demand for AI. It is what it looks like, said John Herman in New York, a small group of large companies handing money back and forth. The last time we witnessed such obscene examples of vendor financing was before the telecom bust in the late 1990s. Unlike the dot-com and telecom bubbles, this is a more stable funding boom, said Liz Hoffman in Semaphore. The robber barons and telecom wildcatters borrowed to build their empires and dragged their financiers down with them. But most of today's AI investment is coming from tech giants that are healthy enough to back the checks their owners are writing. A lot of today's spending could nonetheless prove worthless, said the economist, if AI adoption isn't as fruitful as expected. Although the shelves of data centers and new power capacity could find other uses, billions of dollars worth of servers and specialized chips could become obsolete. America's economy, too, would suffer a nasty shock if these investment projects were scaled back, costing jobs. The bigger the boom gets, the bigger the knock-on consequences of an AI chill could be. And over on the Talking Points page, we've got time for one article. The GOP merging flag and cross. Under President Trump, the U.S. is veering toward Christian nationalism, said Zachary B. Wolf in CNN.com. Since January, a growing number of administration's actions have blurred the lines between church and state. Trump has created a White House faith office, as well as Justice Department task forces charged with targeting anti-Christian policies and threats to religious liberty. His budget office has said workers can now bring religion into the workplace, while his IRS has said churches can endorse political candidates without sacrificing their tax-exempt status. This embrace of Christian nationalism was on stark display at Charlie Kirk's memorial, where Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth evoked the blood of Jesus and spoke of a spiritual war underway. And Trump aide Stephen Miller said the administration is on the side of God and will defeat the forces of wickedness. The clear message, said Stephanie McCrumman in The Atlantic, is that the administration views its political agenda as a cosmic battle against the forces of evil. What we saw at Kirk's memorial wasn't Christian nationalism, said Rich Lowry in National Review. It was religious faith expressed at a Christian's memorial service. Christian nationalism means establishing a religious state to impose Christian values by law, and no one of any consequence favors that. Saying the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation doesn't count, nor does trying to elect Christian leaders or trying to legislate based on Christian morality. Progressives have long disdained the religious right, but there is nothing wrong or theocratic about mixing politics and faith. Just ask former President Joe Biden, who often spoke of God and quoted the Bible. Yes, Christianity and politics have been intertwined in the U.S. since the days of the founders, said David Brooks in the New York Times. They believed that religious institutions were key to maintaining the shared moral order a healthy democracy requires. Throughout history, our leaders have brought their faith to bear on public questions to positive effect. But that wasn't the sentiment on display at Kirk's memorial. The speeches were short on morality and rich in the language of triumph, promoting the assumption that being Christian and Republican are basically the same thing. It was an unsettling reminder that unrestrained faith and unrestrained partisanship are an incredibly combustible mixture, and that people of faith can wander a long way from the cross. And among the short notes, we have, so far this year, about 10% fewer people have been prosecuted for federal drug crimes compared with the same period in 2024, the slowest prosecution rate since the late 1990s. The Trump administration has diverted thousands of federal agents away from drug enforcement and toward immigration raids. Hundreds of federal workers who were laid off during Elon Musk's job-cutting Doge blitz are being asked to return. The employees who manage government workspaces for the General Services Administration were paid through September. Those who return to work will have received the equivalent of a seven-month paid vacation. The FBI has fired at least 15 agents who were photographed kneeling with racial justice protesters in Washington, D.C., following the 2020 police killing of George Floyd. The incident took place after a group of agents was confronted by protesters. Some of the agents said they took a knee to de-escalate the situation. On the poll watch, for the first time in nearly a decade of polling, a majority of Americans, 54%, think the country's best days are behind it. 75% say the U.S. political system needs a complete overhaul or major reforms. 58% of Americans believe that legal immigrants provide a major benefit to the economy, up from 42% in March. 46% say they enrich American culture, up from 38%. And 42% say they take jobs from Americans that Americans don't want. And we will finish out today's show with a quote from Simone Weil. Simple quote, but there's something there. Attention, taken to its highest degree, is the same thing as prayer. With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.